Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, two former military officers and award-winning authors, Elliot Ackerman and Admiral James Stavridis, discuss their recent book, 2034, a novel of the next world war. This conversation originally took place March 31st, 2021, and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
I am just going to now introduce to you our host for the evening is Captain John Allen Williams. He's from Loyola University, Chicago political science professor emeritus, and member of the board of directors of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. He's a professor emeritus of political science, holds degrees from Grinnell College and the University of Pennsylvania, where he has both his master's and his PhD. His writings include works on military strategy, military forces and missions, catastrophic terrorism, defense organizations, civil-military relations, military culture, military professionalism, leadership, professional issues, personnel issues, military education, and strategic policy. So we are very excited to have our two authors tonight and have Captain John Allen Williams with us. So at this point, I want to introduce Captain Williams and have him join us. And he is going to lead us through the program tonight. And we thank you all for joining us this evening. Welcome, Captain Williams.
Thank you, Carrie. Good evening, and thank you to the American Writers Museum for inviting the Pritzker Military Museum and Library to partner with them on this program. I'm delighted to welcome today's guests, the authors of the new book, 2034, a novel of the next world war, Elliot Ackerman and Admiral James Stavridis. Elliot Ackerman is the author of several novels, most recently Red Dress and Black and White. His books have been nominated for the National Book Award, the Andrew Carnegie Medal in both fiction and nonfiction, and the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, among others. His writing often appears in Esquire, The New Yorker, and The New York Times, where he is a contributing opinion writer. His stories have been included in The Best American Short Stories and The Best American Travel Writing. He is both a former White House fellow and a Marine officer. He has served five tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, where he received the Silver Star, the Bronze Star for Valor, and the Purple Heart. He divides his time between New York City and Washington, D.C. Admiral James Stavridis, USN, retired, spent more than 30 years in the U.S. Navy, rising to the rank of four-star admiral. He was the NATO Supreme Allied Commander Europe, and previously commanded U.S. Southern Command, overseeing military operations in Latin America. At sea, he commanded a Navy destroyer, a destroyer squadron, and an aircraft carrier battle group in combat. He holds a PhD from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, where he recently served as 5 years as dean. He has published 9 previous books and hundreds of articles, and is a frequent national and international television commentator, as well as a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion Weekly and for Time Magazine. He is chairman of the Board of Counselors of McClarkey Global Associates, an international consulting firm, and an operating executive of the Carlyle Group, an international private equity firm. Good evening, Elliot and Admiral, and thank you for joining us virtually today.
Wonderful to be with you, Jay. Old friend and shipmate. Thank you, sir.
Seems like a long time ago, my friend, but, you know, small Navy. I'd like to start off with just a few questions on your collaboration and the writing process. I wonder if you could talk a bit about how you came together to work on this book, your joint writing process, and what role each of you played in its development.
Jay, we'll very quickly get to that, but I do want to just sort of set the table in very few quick strokes about how we came to the idea, and then ask my incredible co-author to maybe talk about 5 of the key characters in the book, just so everyone, because I'm going to guess that not everyone has actually read the entire book yet. So let's get everyone on the same sheet of music. We came to this idea of writing a book about 15 years in the future, in the year 2034, by looking to the past. We began by thinking about the Cold War, U.S.-Soviet Union. And one of the reasons we never ended up going to a hot war with the Soviet Union is because there was a rich body of literature, both film and novels, about how terrible it would be. Think Doctor Strangelove, Red Storm Rising, The Third World War by Sir John Hackett, Failsafe, On the Beach, many others. We were able to imagine how horrific the experience would be of a global war with nuclear powers. So we kind of looked back and realized, you know, we're headed toward potentially a conflict with China. And, you know, that may or may not occur, but one way we might prevent it is to imagine our way to that future and understand how terrible it would be if these two nations, these two great countries, were to sleepwalk into a war, perhaps because of a miscalculation, because of tensions that rise, for example, in the South China Sea, where the book opens. So the idea was to create a cautionary tale. Some people have said to me, oh, Admiral, you've written a predictive novel here. Not so much. I hope not. But I'm certain that we've written a cautionary tale. And this is not Tom Clancy. Technology is not the center of this. It's a classic literary novel, in my view, with characters at the heart of it, several of whom represent, if you will, actors on that global stage. So maybe I could ask Elliot to talk a little bit about those characters to help set the table, and then we can come on to the writing process that you asked about, Jim.
Great.
Sure. Thanks, Jim. So to sort of set the stage of the book opens in the South China Sea, a body of water that is half the size of the continental United States, but that today the Chinese government claims as territorial waters in dispute with international convention that classifies them as international waters. So as such, we and our allies conduct freedom of navigation patrols in the South China Sea to assert that they are in fact international waters. So the novel opens on one of these freedom of navigation patrols in which Commodore Sarah Hunt, a second generation naval officer, her father worked in U.S. Naval Special Warfare. She herself in the year 2034 is also a veteran of Naval Special Warfare, but is ending her career in the surface fleet. And she is on what she believes will probably be her last patrol, this Freedom of Navigation patrol, commanding a flotilla of destroyers. And as they're at sea, they spy what appears to be a Chinese fishing trawler in duress, and they go to render aid. Shortly thereafter, they discover that what appears to be a fishing trawler is anything but. So now cut to our second principal character, which is Major Chris Wedge Mitchell, fourth generation Marine fighter pilot. His call sign Wedge alludes to the fact that a wedge is in fact the world's oldest and simplest tool. And so is Wedge. We meet him. He is flying his state-of-the-art F-35 joint strike fighter over the Straits of Hormuz, flirting with Iranian airspace, and lamenting the fact that behind the stick and throttle of an F-35, he doesn't feel much like a fighter pilot, like his father, grandfather, and great-grandfather before him, that this doesn't really feel so much like flying. It feels more like being a technician. And as he's lamenting this, he loses control of his aircraft, literally. The controls are no longer responsive to him, and he is not flying at all. His aircraft the control is taken away from him, and the F-35 diverts into Iranian airspace on a descent towards Andhra Abbas Air Base. Now we cut to our third principal character, Dr. Sandy Chowdhury, a graduate of the illustrious Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, who works in the National Security Council. He is trying to figure out what is going on with these two emerging crises, one over the Straits of Hormuz and the other in the South China Sea, when his telephone rings. And on the other end of the line is our fourth principal character, the Chinese military attaché to the United States, Admiral Lin Bao. Admiral Lin Bao is Chinese, but of interesting parentage. He was born to an American mother and raised in China. And he has a message for Sandy Chowdhury. That's that these two events are not unrelated, and that the Chinese government has finally grown sick and tired of these Freedom of Navigation patrols in American waters, and that they have a message for the United States. That message is promptly delivered at the very end of the first chapter, and it is a cyber attack in which the Chinese government basically blinks the entire eastern seaboard. The lights go on, the lights come back on, the lights go off, and they come right back on. But when they come back on, everything, power and otherwise, is not completely restored. And I would just cut to our very last principal character in the book, and that is when Wedge, when his aircraft lands on the tarmac in Iran, waiting for him is Brigadier Qasim Farshad of the Iranian Quds Force. General Farshad is a veteran of the Forever Wars. However, he fought on the other side of these conflicts in places like Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, and others. And he is the namesake of Qasim Soleimani. Qasim Farshad being named for Soleimani when his father died subverting an assassination attempt on Soleimani, and was then taken under Soleimani's wing. So those five characters, an international cast, are the ones who take you into the world of 2034, which begins with these two crises that quickly spread to a global conflagration. And so that's basically, that's what the beginning of the book is.
And let me just pick up with the answer to the excellent question that Captain Williams asked us, which is, what was the creative process like? Essentially, I started with a big idea. I went to my editor at Penguin Press, Random House, and my editor said, you know, Admiral, you're a great guy. You've written 9 books of nonfiction, but we think a good idea would be to have a real novelist. That kind of hurt me a little bit, but I am a debut novelist, and I was thrilled when my editor said, we have somebody in mind, this guy named Elliot Ackerman, whom I've known for a long time. I'll let Elliot tell that part of it. But quickly, our editor put us together, and then we began to work in a way that I think Elliot can describe perhaps better than I can. And I will simply say it was a joy to work with Elliot every single day. Elliot?
Right. So, so just to add to that, you know, the Admiral and I have known each other for the better part of 10 years, both being graduates of the aforementioned illustrious Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, where he served as dean. When he came on as dean, he very kindly invited me to be writer in residence at Fletcher first semester. When he sent me what my duties would be, one of the bullet points in that list was talk with the dean about books when he feels like it. So, you know, we had a history of talking about books. I knew what his tastes were. And as he mentioned, we shared an editor. So when this concept was put to me, I was very excited about it. It seemed like a really natural extension of our friendship and our shared love of literature. And so we sat down and said, let's see if we can write the first chapter. And I basically already described to you the first chapter, and the rest is history. And we wrote this book, and to echo Jim's sentiments, I've often told people since it's come out, for a book on a very grim subject, i.e. global war, we had a lot of fun writing it, and we actually think it's a pretty fun book as well.
Well, if people aren't hooked now to go get the book, they will be. I have to tell you, I got it, and I enjoyed it immensely. I could barely put it down. And I thought I was back in Newport at a war game that, you know, yeah, we both played, at least I as a junior officer and you as, you know, somebody important. The problem with those war games was that we could never get the war started. And yet the scenario that you came up with is absolutely credible. I could never figure out what would make the Russians invade Western Europe, but I could sure figure out how China and the United States might get into it. And this is truly a cautionary tale. I also think that it's appropriate for a time in which everything seems to be spiraling out of control, mm-hmm, to read a novel about one of the worst scenarios for a war, how that might also unintentionally go places no one intended. I think it's just about perfect. I have no more questions about the book itself, but except to ask, to what extent have you brought your own military experiences into the plot? And obviously, you know stuff because you were in the military and doing important things. But is there something in particular that you identify with in this plot, or perhaps certain of the characters that you are drawn to because of some maybe autobiographical experiences?
Well, I'll kick off. Obviously, Sarah Hunt, the Commodore, who's driving her destroyers through the South China Sea. There's a fair amount of this old surface warfare officer. I've been a destroyer captain. I've been a Commodore of a destroyer squadron. I've been a strike group commander, which Sarah ascends to. So I know that terrain extremely well. But it may surprise you that the character I find the most compelling to me, who talked to me more, was Admiral Lin Bao, the Chinese admiral. At the start of the book, he's trapped in this desk job in Washington, D.C. He hates it. All he can think about is, how do I get back to sea? How do I get on the bridge of a ship? I've been there, 6 tours in the Pentagon. Jay, over your left shoulder, I see your badge of honor from the old Oppo 6.
The Knights on Horseback.
Yeah, we know that terrain well. And I think you'll agree with me, as you're doing that important work of the nation in the Pentagon, you just want to get back to sea. And then Lin Bao talks several times about his aspiration when he's done with his career in the military. He wants to be a teacher. And I think that's what appealed to me at the end of my 37 years in the Navy, was the idea that I could become an educator like you did, Jay, and be involved in teaching the next generation who come along. So for me, those two characters, there's a lot of me in there, but you'll find little snippets of Stavridis and some of the other characters. Elliot tells this better than I do.
I don't know about that, but I would just echo that there's snippets of the two of us liberally drizzled over every single character. I mean, there's some that probably obviously, you know, I have connections to, you know, Wedge, the generation Marine fighter pilot. I served as a Marine, although I was in special operations, but I think there's certainly a similar type of elan that exists in the fighter pilot community and in the special operations community. And like the Admiral, I also related to a character like Qasem Farshad, a veteran of the Forever Wars, and he is very much a projection of what I would imagine myself being like had I stayed in the service for 20 more years and just being the opposite side of that coin. But I think one of the joys of writing fiction and creating characters is I have an associative mind. So I'm always sort of trying to pull what seem to be unrelated things together. And when I make those associations, particularly in characters, even in a plot, and you can see the connections that might not always be self-evident, I think there's great joy in that. So in some regards, the parts of the book I take the most pride in are the parts of the book that are the least expected and the connections between characters that are the least obvious as well.
Can I add one thought to that, which I know Elliot agrees with, which is that our objective here was not to pick out the good guys and the bad guys. Our objective was to tell these stories and allow each of the characters to step onto the stage and tell the reader, what do the Chinese think? What do the Iranians think? What do the Russians think? We kind of have a sense about what the US thinks. And by the way, how about India, a vast country which looms large in the landscape of 2034. So as Elliot says, the joy of writing fiction that I've discovered and that he knows well is that you throw off that straitjacket of nonfiction where everything's footnoted, everything's referenced, everything's in the bibliography. You've got to defend every fact, and you paint with the brush of imagination on an enormous canvas. That's a pretty wonderful experience for a writer.
Another role of the novelist or the screenwriter or the dramatist is to bring up ideas that wouldn't occur to people who are just looking at operations plans. Someone said that 9/11 was a failure of imagination as well as a failure of intelligence. And now, thanks to your book, there's one huge failure that everyone can imagine only too well. Interestingly, Tom Clancy did foreshadow a 9/11 type attack in one of his novels. But as you pointed out, his novels were very different. They were technologically driven, plot driven for sure, not so much character driven, right. But just very detailed. And what your book has done, this elevated strategy to the front row of what you're reading about, and it's centered around a big think in a way that these books tend not to be. And you get sucked in and you're learning whether you want to or not. Freddie Clay suggested in his book, Every War Must End, which I'm sure you're familiar with, that nations start wars in order for peace. In other words, but they want the peace that will happen after they win the war. That's the peace they're working for. But they need to think carefully about a story by which they go from where they are now to where they're in a better place. And that nations shouldn't start wars unless they have a plausible theory of victory. And these unintended escalations kind of interfere with that kind of thought process. Obviously, Japan and Pearl Harbor, Germany, World War I, unconventional submarine warfare, it didn't end well for them. But I wonder if this is still a danger. Are we likely, not just we, but other countries, likely to be concerned with sort of narrow strategic concern and not look seriously about what might go wrong? Can we think clearly about what the results will be if something is started?
I think that one of the reasons war is such a fascinating subject is because at its core is human miscalculation. And I think you know your question hits it right on the head for me, which is these are about stories. And when a nation starts telling itself the wrong story or a story that's rooted in certain delusions, mm-hmm. That's how you walk into disastrous wars, whether it's, you know, the stories that that Germany was telling itself in the lead up to the Second World War about the Lebensraum and their future, or the miscalculation of Pearl Harbor, or stories that the United States is telling itself at the current moment about our own inevitable invincibility. Those stories really matter. And I think one of the great things that's so fascinating and interesting about war is all war, baked into all war, is human miscalculation, because both sides believe they can win. And obviously everyone can't win the war. So obviously somebody's story isn't right. And it's always that way, you know, since the dawn of human existence. And so I think one of the things, you know, we aspire to capture in this book, yes, it's about China, yes, it deals with technology and cyber warfare, but we never wanted to lose sight of the enduring and indelible nature of war.
Now, let me add a thought to that, which is picture yourself just over 100 years ago in 1905. And so you're a European, and your story is that war is over. There'll never be another war. There are serious books written by powerful intellectuals like Emil Bloch that postulate that all of our economies are so intertwined, we'll never go to war. We're right. So sophisticated. We understand that there are no winners in a war. And oh, by the way, the royal families of all of these nations are intertwined by blood and marriage. How'd that work out? Go read Barbara Tuchman, The Guns of August, and you'll understand how not just nations, but civilizations sleepwalk into a war that ends 4 years later with the conclusion, if you will, of the Russian Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the Ottoman Empire. This is a powerful lesson. And we try to pick up that thread in 2034 that the greater forces that are propelling nations toward a war can be sparked, like I snap my fingers, the way they were in 1914 when the Archduke of the Austro-Hungarian Empire is assassinated by a Serbian nationalist in a remote corner of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And yet the result of that is 80 million dead between the First and the Second World Wars. So if you look at 2034, the novel, it's a spark that occurs in the South China Sea between relatively young people in their 30s and 40s in command of ships and aircraft. You know, this is not President Xi from 1,000 miles away turning a screwdriver. These are young people doing what they think is the right thing on both sides. And that creates a spark that ends up in a war. That is all too real in human history.
Well, Elliot, you mentioned wisely that war is a human operation, is a human thing, and that you have to bear people in mind at all times to understand it. But humans interact with things and with technology in war. And the question for me is, what is the role of technology in future war, especially something I know that Admiral is particularly concerned with, cyber warfare? To what extent does this make the human element less important? Are we doing enough to develop the necessary technologies and understanding how to use them?
Well, I would just start with one of the ideas that this novel very much interrogates is, yes, the specific technologies, but also this question of what happens when you have the most state-of-the-art technology, but it is, in fact, the wrong technology. If one or a nation becomes over-reliant upon the wrong technology, it becomes that technology can become a real hindrance in a war. And without giving too much away from the book, we see how certain technologies are appropriate for the conflict we imagine, and other technologies, which are state of the art, are rendered useless. And that one of the great levelers in 2034 is cyber. And I'm sure we'll talk some more about cyber, but, you know, as someone who loves history, kind of an example that was always rattling around in the back of my mind was the Battle of Agincourt in the early 15th century. For those of you who aren't familiar with it, that's when a group of extremely well-armed and armored, technologically superior French knights in the most cutting-edge armament of the day met with a bunch of English longbowmen who had no such advantages on an opposite side of a muddy field. And when they marched into that muddy field with the greatest equipment anyone could imagine at the time and met these pretty low-tech but well-trained English longbowmen, they were slaughtered in the hundreds, and the English carried the day against all expectations. And so the book plays around just with similar ideas of, yes, it's, you know, the United States right now, we have state-of-the-art technologies, and we continue to have a military dominance that we've enjoyed for several decades now. But as we enter into this 21st century, and this 21st century, we get to mid-century, and as we imagine to the 2030s, it's worth doing the hard work of asking ourselves, is this technology the right technology? Is our posture the correct posture for the types of challenges that we're facing?
It's hard to know ahead of time what's going to pay off. We used to worry in our anti-submarine warfare area, what happens if the seas were to become invisible somehow, and the advantages of stealth would no longer exist, and there would go our most important nuclear deterrent.
One of the things we explore in the book, by the way, is the mirror image of that, which is that what if you could make the surface of the ocean stealthy? What if large, massive ships on the surface of the ocean could disappear? I don't think that's impossible to consider, certainly in the 15-year future and beyond. So yeah, those are two sides of the same coin.
Very interesting. Back in those good days when we could get on airplanes and go places, there was a conference in Portugal on military studies, strategic studies in a post-truth era. I thought it was very illuminating, and it made people do a lot of thinking, because we are in that era now, I think, when issues of culture and identity erode the possibility of basic agreements, even on facts, what evidence would you use for facts, and are there things that we can all agree on? And it's less and less true. You used to say, I would tell my students, look, you're entitled to your own opinions. You're not entitled to your own facts. Sure. And then, you know, I think I got out just in time, frankly, because I think they have a different view on that. I could get in big trouble for a whole lot of things now. But these things intensify political instability. And so I guess my question, do you agree that this makes us dysfunctional politically? And how does it affect our ability to think and act strategically?
I think you hit it right on the head. I couldn't agree with you more. I say yes, it absolutely affects our ability to think and act strategically. And I think the dysfunction at home translates into weakness abroad. And I think as much as this book is a wake-up call vis-a-vis our relationship with China, it should also be a wake-up call that our dysfunction at home has real consequences as we look past our own shores. You know, when we look, for instance, after the September 11th attacks, I mean, we were coming out of an election in this country that was an extremely divisive election in 2000. I mean, settled by a few hundred votes in Florida. Yet that very next year, the country was able to come together in the face of an external threat. Yes. And obviously that unity, you know, it dissipated over time and the wars became contentious. And but you know, we faced this past year a truly existential threat in the pandemic. And I think it's disappointing probably for Americans across the political spectrum to reflect on the fact that no one can look back at 2020 and say it was a year of national unity. And so as much as we're talking about threats that exist beyond our 2034, I think it's important to also reflect on the fact that we can only meet those threats if we have the capacity to fight our disagreement to unite when the United States is threatened. And I'll just bring up one thing specific to the book. You know, there is a character in the book that is the president of the United States, and that character is a female, which I think is not remarkable. Shocked by 2034, we had not had our first female president. But the one thing that is, I think, a little bit more unique is that that character is a political independent and has been elected as an independent. I think too often in this country, we seem to believe that's written somewhere in our founding documents are the words Republican and Democrat, or at least notion that there have to be two political parties. That's nowhere in our founding documents. Our only political independent as president was our first president, George Washington. And on the way out the door in his farewell address, he went to great pains to warn about what he called factions, which we call parties today. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the United States is also, as much as we are in the midst of an international reordering, we're also in the midst of a political reordering at home. And hopefully that leads to a more functional and responsive government that allows us in the future to respond to external threats with internal unity.
Yes.
Yeah. Let me just add to that, if I could. As someone who is the dad of two millennials in their early 30s and who commanded hundreds of thousands of millennials in the field in, for example, Afghanistan, a NATO mission, let me tell you something about the millennial generation. They are, I think, going to become the next American hero generation. You know, we talk about the greatest generation. I'm all for the people that fought World War II. Terrific. This millennial crowd is not self-centered. They are about what's right. They have a keen sense of social justice. I also had thousands of them pass through my halls as the dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. They will stand and deliver for the United States of America. And certainly those in the military have done so already at great personal expense. And I'll conclude on this point by simply saying, this may be the next great generation. And let me tell you, my two daughters, their husbands, both very accomplished physicians, they just look at the two political parties and they shake their heads. We are not, in my view, headed toward an inevitable future with Republicans and Democrats. There is a reckoning coming for the political yes. parties in this country.
Elliot.
I can just make one point to piggyback on what the Admiral said. I also do a lot of work as a journalist, and I was recently on assignment for Smithsonian Magazine, kind of speculating on what the Global War on Terrorism Memorial that's been proposed for the National Mall would look like. And I found myself in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, talking to a former Marine who was going to take me on a tour of their local war memorial to 9/11 veterans. And he was about seven or eight years younger than me. And we were having breakfast. It was me, him, the photographer on the assignment, and his wife at a Cracker Barrel there on Memorial. And as we were sort of speculating this, we were both Marines. We're talking about the Marine Corps. We served in the same 8th Marine Regiment. He asked me how old I was. That's an interesting position. I was born in 1980. So depending on who you ask, I'm either a millennial, just barely, with the cutoff being 1980, or Gen X, if the cutoff is 1981. And so I was making this point to him, and I said that, you know, I actually have another friend. And that friend of mine, he said that he was in a similar position. He said, well, you can really define someone as whether or not they are millennial is if when the September 11th attacks happened, if that memory for them was an adult memory or a child memory. And so I relayed that to this, you know, former Marine who was a bit younger than me. He said, oh, that's interesting. And I said, well, when did you decide you wanted to join the Marine Corps? He said, well, I was about 11 years old. And I said, oh, what happened? He said, well, the September 11th attacks. I said, well, I guess, and I said, I guess you're not a millennial then, because that's a pretty adult reaction if you decided at 11 that you were going to run off and join the Marine Corps. And he sort of got a little bit cross with me how dismissive I was being of millennials. And he said, listen, Elliot, let me remind you that the millennial generation is the generation that's fought our nation's two longest wars exclusively as volunteers.
Yes.
I think the millennial generation often gets a bad rap and people forget.
Yeah.
I could not agree more.
Exactly.
And Elliot Ackerman, you are a millennial, let me tell you, because you stood and delivered for this country. This generation will go down as the new greatest generation. I guarantee it.
My students at Loyola, the military students I work with at Northwestern and Loyola, there's no question about it. I'm very proud of all of them, and many of them have gone on to do great things in the military and otherwise. We've talked about a lot of national security threats. What interest do either of you have in joining the government and helping to solve them?
For lots of different jobs since leaving the military. I was vetted for vice president by Hillary Clinton, one of six people actually vetted for the job. I was then offered a cabinet post by Donald Trump. I think of that as two bullets whizzing by my head at high speed. But in all seriousness, I am always open to further national service to the nation.
Yeah. Well, yes. I think Elliot? Maybe if you'd been on the ticket, Hillary might have won.
Hardly. Elliot?
I'm very happy with what I'm doing now. I love the work that I get to do now. I mean, listen, never say never when it comes to serving your country. So I'll never say never, but I don't have any immediate plans. And I like to think I serve my country by writing books.
Yeah, I think that's true. Finally, now that everybody who's gone near it is hooked on your book, what is the possibility of a further collaboration and perhaps even a sequel?
I'd say it's very high, and I don't want to reveal anything other than that Elliot and I are having conversations about thinking beyond 2034. How about 2054? How about 2074, 84? But I'll let Elliot address, because he's closer to it than I am. The really logical question is, when does the movie come out?
Well, Elliot? I thought of that.
I think we both be open to a collaboration. And I think, it'd be great to see it on a screen. So, yes. I hope so. And, we'll have to see.
Well, I'm relieved to hear that, because I need another fix, and the sooner the better. And thank you to our audience for tuning in today. And a special thanks to our guests, Elliot Ackerman and Admiral James Stavridis, for being with us today and sharing your experiences and insights. It has been a great personal pleasure to speak with you. Their book, 2034, A Novel of the Next World War, is currently available on our online library at www.pritzkermilitary.org in both ebook and audiobook formats. Additionally, the book is available for purchase in bookstores and online. Thank you again for joining us today, and please watch for future programming from the American Writers Museum and the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, acclaimed writers A.O. Scott and Rafia Zakaria discuss the legacy of Henry David Thoreau and their contributions to the essay anthology Now Comes Good Sailing, Writers Reflect on Henry David Thoreau. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.